Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as audio and video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their fabulous yearly writers conference, please go to pnwa.org. You know, Author Magazine, while we do provide articles on the craft of writing and the business of writing, is not so much a how-to-write magazine, but a why-we-write magazine. This, to me, has always been the question I felt I've needed to answer again and again and again in my daily working life. Why do I write? It's what I teach when I teach. And it's what I write about in Author every day, and what I talk to the authors about when I have them on this show and on my interviews. And today's guest, novelist, short story writer, and essayist Joan Frank, has written a book about the writing life, which answers this question, why do we write, in its very title. But instead of me stealing her thunder, I'm going to let her tell you what this book is called right now. Joan, welcome to Author to Author.
Yes. Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be with you.
It's my pleasure. So, okay, why do we write?
Because we have to. Paraphrase the title of my own new book of essays, which I'm very thankful to you for discussing today.
Yes, it's Because You Have To, A Writing Life by Joan Frank, and excellent work, first of all. I recommend it to all my writing brethren. And here is why, Joan, aside from the essays being so finely done. The reason I like this collection is it deals with something near and dear to my heart, which is the life of the writer away from the desk.
Right.
It addresses
absolutely right.
The whole of the... And I say, and you obviously agree with me, God bless you, that when you choose to write, that experience, that choice to be a writer continues to affect your day whether you are actually writing or not. Would you say that's so?
Absolutely true. And, you know, it functions both as a blessing and a curse, that constant mindfulness that one is making writing as one goes about one's life, because the blessing, of course, is that life feeds you the richest possible material. And so everywhere you turn, there is authenticity to mine and to tap and to steal and to hoard and to use and reshape and mold for your work. The curse is that some part of you is always a little bit on the outside looking in. Some part of you is never quite completely present in the life that is happening, but keeping a third-person eye on the whole proceeding.
And that is so true, Joan.
Okay.
That is so true. Yeah, go. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, and the trickiness for a writer is that friends and family can hold that against you, because they'll feel like they're not getting all of you. It can feel a little bit like an adulterous affair that never ends.
Yeah.
That the writing is the lover that's waiting off impatiently in the wings, and the writer cannot wait to beat a hasty retreat from the Thanksgiving meal or the romance because he or she has to go and write it down
and think about it
on paper.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, and it's one of the challenges if you have a personality or an approach to life that is oriented towards writing, which is that you are for sure an observer. You just absolutely are. You need to be, I think. And I interviewed Kevin Blyer 2 or 3 months ago. He wrote a book called Me the People. He writes for The Daily Show, so he's a funny guy, and he wrote this very, very interesting and funny book about the creation of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
And he said he doesn't know what he thinks until he's written it.
That's absolutely
correct. He doesn't know
correct.
What he believes until he's written it. And that must be
That's
true of all of
absolutely true.
Writers.
Yeah. It's true. You don't, and more than one writer has said famously over time, I write to find out what I think. I write to find out what I believe. And I think that's one of the most basic excitements built into the writing life. It's almost like following a divining rod or
yeah.
a personal Ouija board.
Yeah.
Stories take you where you didn't know you had to go. Both
yeah.
stories and essays, I might add.
Oh,
fiction
absolutely.
And nonfiction. Yes, absolutely. And it's delicious. It's like a treasure hunt. And always, inevitably, you're made larger by what you learn.
Oh, for sure. Your perspective is always broadened, I think. One of the lessons I've taught myself, so I write a column, an essay,
mm-hmm.
4 to 5 days a week for the magazine. And I used to try to sort of know what I was going to, you know, since you have to do it every day, you want to really kind of, I thought it would be a good idea to kind of know, essentially construct it in my head before I get to the page. Because sometimes I sit
right.
around and I have conversations and I go, oh, that conversation, that what we just talked about, that would make a good blog. Thank God I have something to write about tomorrow.
Absolutely.
What I found was when I came to the page, and 400 words, you can write that practically in your head if you're so inclined.
Yeah.
If I went to the page like that, knowing what I had to say, it was never as good as if I went with a basic starting place and allowed myself to discover, even in 400 words, that it was.
Oh, now
that
that's interesting.
I would
Bill.
Still discover, even in the 400 words, I would leave it open. Don't presume you know, Bill. Don't presume
uh-huh.
you know where this is going.
Uh-huh.
Even in 400 words. Absolutely.
You know, in a way, thank heaven for that, because otherwise I think writers would just be in despair. If writers go in believing that they have to know it before it gets down, that would be a terrible, terrible
yes.
corner to paint oneself into, I think. I mean,
right,
I,
and that
I,
way lies writer's block. It's got to be.
True.
One of the causes.
Now, I know a lot of writers operate schematically, and they have they like to have very careful outlines and so on, and some may succeed very well doing that, and I don't mean to eliminate them, but for most, not to say many, it works as a process of discovery, and really that's really the driving force, the motivation, and that I think that's what makes a lot of us keep ourselves in the game, because we want to find out what comes next.
Yes.
At many levels.
Absolutely. And in fact, I wrote a column published a couple of days ago where, and I think this is absolutely true, where I said, you know, you got to compare writing to a conversation, not a monologue. Even though you're the only one there, you're really in conversation with something, whether you want to call it your imagination or your muse or God or whatever. You're in a conversation with something because something is surprising you. Something
the other
is
part, oh,
coming
absolutely.
To you.
Absolutely true. The other way it makes us larger, I think, Bill, is that it forces us to imagine ourselves in the minds and souls and hearts of others.
Yeah.
And I think that as a sheer exercise, even if the pages never leave the desk drawer, that's important for someone making art. It makes you have to be larger than yourself.
Yeah.
As simple as that.
Yes, you have to every day, especially if you're a fiction writer. But actually, I will tell you, so I'm writing nonfiction now. I'm writing a memoir
mm-hmm.
about myself. And it really is just as applicable, perhaps
I'm sure.
even more so in a way,
mm-hmm.
which I could talk about maybe, but that you must practice compassion when you go
mm-hmm.
to the desk. You've got to. You can't write about humanity without it, unless you want them all to be cartoon characters.
Well, you have to sort of be God, but a compassionate God, like
yes.
Flaubert was when he said, you know, Madame Bovary, c'est moi.
Yes, yes.
He was
absolutely.
In the plants, he was in the flowers, he was in the,
yeah.
the bottle of wine, he was in the newspapers on the side table. He was everywhere.
Well, but you kind of have to be, because you have to
you do.
Empathize with your world.
It's absolutely true, but it's part of the joy. And I think because, Bill, I really do believe that the writing life is not for the faint-hearted, ironically. paradoxically. It's a very, very tough and difficult life.
It certainly can be, but as you say in your, but this is, and this is one of the things I'd like to get to, is because you have to, a writing life, because you have to. And so one of the challenges sometimes, and you write about it very amusingly and very intelligently and poignantly about the experience of being, I forget the name of the, I'm not going to try and find the name of the essay now, but you're writing about dealing with who you talk, be careful who you talk to about it, basically, about the fact that you're a writer.
Yeah, it's called Be Careful Who You Tell, Whom You
Tell. Right, and you were talking about the experience of speaking about the fact that you're a writer, your art, with people who aren't writers or really aren't in the arts at all. And this is what I'm getting to with this question, which is that, or this sort of idea, which is you can sound a little precious sometimes to people who aren't doing it when you say things like, because you have to. Like, well, you don't have to. No one's putting a gun to your head. But the truth
That's true.
The truth is you kind of do have to. And that's really the only reason you should do it.
You kind of do. It's almost like being bitten by a vampire. You know, once it's the bite has gone into the bloodstream, the bite of feeling how it feels to make writing in a way that matters somehow, then you're sort of hooked forever. But you have to be in order to withstand, sorry to paraphrase, the slings and arrows.
Yeah.
Of the life, including the response of the public who may or may not understand what it means for you, and the difficulty of surviving as a working artist. You need that driving fire, the thing that keeps your senses and mind alive above all else, which is to make new work. You need it, and you have to have it. And it's like, and also I like to use the analogy of Dorothy's red shoes or sparkling ruby slippers.
Yeah.
You know, when a writer knows existentially and logically that she or he can quit any time. You can quit any time. There's always that existential back door. If you want to quit, quit. And you can be done with it forever. And most writers who are hopelessly deep in the game at this point, when they put that option to themselves, they can't possibly accept it. They just can't.
Yeah. And in fact...
So there it is.
Yes, and in fact, Joan, I had reached a point in my writing where it was just, the whole experience becomes so unpleasant. Everything, the rejection and even the writing really had become so unpleasant. The whole thing infected with a kind of ugly striving, and it was just more painful than it was pleasurable.
Bill.
Well, you know, but I did something that I had never done in my life that I needed to do, which I said, Bill, you can get out. But, I mean, I really gave myself a chance to get out. Because it's one thing to sort of say, well, you don't have to do it, but to say, no, this is it. You are allowed to quit now if you want to. And when I did that, I swear to you, my imagination immediately summoned my 13-year-old self sitting at his typewriter writing his first novel before school in the morning. And I heard in my head, I was standing in the middle of a restaurant where I was working, I heard in my head, what would you tell him?
Oh, my goodness. That's a wonderful story.
And that was in for good. I said, okay, I'm in. I don't know how we're going to do this. I'm not going to suffer like I've been. I got to change something, but I'm in. But I had to do it. I had to
do
it.
Lovely. That's a lovely story. I hope you tell and tell and tell that story.
Oh, I do.
And see how wonderful... how deathless stories are. The thing that really kills me and just keeps blowing my mind is the deathlessness of the story form. And I mean this both for nonfiction and fiction.
Yeah.
Like the little story you just told.
Mm-hmm.
That was a zinger. And it's memorable. And when stories are memorable, they go inside our bodies and they live in us forever.
That's
just
right.
As long as we live.
That's right.
That's a freaking miracle.
Great interview with Lydia Yuknovich. She's on the current issue of Author.
Oh God, I love her.
She's great, and it's right where we begin. She said that stories are quantum, that they live within us the way atoms and energy live within us.
They do. They become part of our very tissue. I truly believe this. I truly believe it. So the deathlessness of the form is part of the reward. But I have to admit to you that from time to time, you know, I still do. The book, the collection of essays, because you have to, may make it sound as though I have dusted my hands of being tempted by quitting, or maybe I'm no longer vulnerable to depression and discouragement and despair. That's not true at all. Those things assault me regularly.
Sure.
And then I wander around tripping over my lower lip trying to figure out how to deal with it, what to think, what to do. And so I have to go through the same processes again and again that are outlined in these essays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, putting the bottom line question to oneself that one-ups all the other questions, which is, what would you rather be doing?
That's right.
And
that's
you have
right.
to live. You have to live it again and again.
You know, I used to coach people on how to deal with the rejection letters, and I tried to coach them to a point where they wouldn't feel the sting of the rejection letters. Tried to point out, like, look, it's just someone saying no thank you, and you say no thank you to things all the time, and there's things you love and there's things you don't love. And I was trying to do all this coaching to help them so that when and if that letter came that said no to this thing that they love, they didn't suffer this you know, existential pain of their valuelessness or whatever the story they're telling because of that rejection letter. But I've come to this conclusion. It's not that the rejection letters don't matter. It's that the pain of the rejection letters doesn't matter. In other words, you aren't that pain. You, Joan, the big you, is the one to which your attention always returns when you find yourself, when you get the letter no or whatever it is, or the advance isn't what you want, whatever it is, and you start telling this terrible story, nobody cares, I'll never, whatever the story we tell ourselves in our isolation, in our insomniac's bed, or wherever we do it.
Yeah.
But it's always the you who returns, who says, but I still want to write. But I'm still interested in another idea. But I still, that's the truth. All the stuff, even the pain, is just a story you're telling yourself temporarily.
Well, that's very interesting, Bill. That's a very interesting idea. And, you know, framing it as a temporary story is also a lovely,
lovely idea. It's what it is.
Idea.
It's a temporary story.
I wonder, did you get a story.
It's a crappy story.
Did you get a chance to look at the essay called For My Brothers and Sisters in the Rejection Business? Because that's in this book, and it talks about how I am rejection's old mistress, and I know all the old roué's tricks.
Yeah, I do.
The story I tell myself about it is that it's proof of motion. Rejection is proof of motion and proof of life and risk. And without motion, nothing can happen. So essentially, what I try to convince myself and others whom I hope will read this piece, what you try to do with rejection is harness it, harness the energy of rejection and make it take you somewhere.
Yeah.
Namely, evidence of life, evidence that you're getting your stuff out into the world, and evidence that you're pumping the math odds that in that blizzard of no, that there's going to be like a sperm, one tiny sperm, there's going to be a tiny yes.
Think of all the four rejected sperm the world over.
Yes, billions of them.
Billions of them.
Beyond mathematical comprehension.
That's
so
right.
So you have to somehow envision it that way, that you're harvesting the energy of putting into the world your stuff, and that eventually, in all of those no's, one small yes will come. And that's essentially the way any of us builds a body of work,
of course.
In effect.
And Richard Bach had a great way of talking about it. I loved what he said, which is, you know, when I had a chance to talk to him, he said, you know, you're not looking for a publisher. You're looking for a member of your intellectual family.
And that's lovely.
That's who you're looking for. And you know what's funny, John? The time I've met people like my agent and this other guy who published the stuff I used to write, it felt almost like cheating because I knew when I met them that they were the right person. It wasn't like being accepted. There was no acceptance in it. There was just a recognition of a friend. You know how when you meet someone you know is your friend.
Yeah, in fact, you might have even felt related to them somehow.
That's much so.
That's wonderful.
And
that's
I think
when that can happen, that's absolutely the best.
And it can. But I think that, and our job as writers, I absolutely maintain this, that our job, and I was just teaching some people this the other day, is it's not to write beautifully, it's to write accurately. the beautiful, let the beautiful
absolutely
thing come
true
and you be accurate. Be accurate
absolutely
so that people
true
can see it, so your family can find you. They won't
that's
find
right
you if you're not
you
accurate,
know
if you try and disguise yourself.
Right. The famous phrase is getting it right. Getting it right. That's all you live for, is to get it exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's why you take a comma out and put a comma in.
Do you like that
remember,
end of it, the taking the comma out and putting it in? Do you enjoy that part?
I have to laugh every time I find it happening because it's so documented, you know.
Yeah.
It's such a documented moment in the making of work. The other thing about rejection and like minds and unlike minds that I like to point out to readers is that literary taste is possibly one of the most volatile subjects there are.
Mm-hmm.
That it's completely arbitrary and capricious, and that you can argue until you're blue, but you probably won't persuade people to like or not like whatever it is they've decided they like or don't like.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The task becomes to align yourself with like minds whenever you can, or enjoy the discussion, one of the two.
Well, absolutely. You know, I can't think of the number of times. It's one thing to look at a book and say, God, this thing is so popular. I can't stand it. I don't think it. But then I will see things that are popular and maybe have been lauded up one side, down the other by critics and so on, and I still don't like it. I can't help it. I don't. I mean, I just don't. And I understand why
that happens to all of us all the time. That happens to all of us. So much of the time, you really sometimes feel like you're bashing your head against something hard. But once, what saves everything is when the beautiful, brilliant piece of work comes through that just blasts your mind away, and then nothing else matters except that you found this thing.
And are you saying that it's interesting that you use that word? Are you talking about something that you found and you wrote, or something you found and you read?
Something you found in reading, because that's also part of the driving fire.
Of course it is. So, but you find it when you write it too, don't you?
Well, of course. But if you find something beautiful in reading, if it was a certain kind of work, in my experience, it has this delicious, peculiar effect of effecting a quickening inside the writer. In other words, the writer becomes more attuned, rather mysteriously, to his or her own project, his or her own task, his or her own appetite for that task. If you read certain kinds of work, it makes you more alive to your own work.
Do you have this experience? Yes and no. Well, yes, yes, I have. And I have sometimes had the experience, although maybe not anymore. Actually, now, to be honest, not anymore. But there was a period in my life, and it went for a while, where if I read someone who had a voice that I loved,
mm-hmm,
my God, that thing would infiltrate. You know, like the worst thing to do is like have Faulkner in your head or something when you start trying to, you know, then it just becomes a mess. But that would happen to me. I would find myself, but I think it was when I was a more insecure writer probably. But now I am inspired by, yes, I am inspired, because it reminds me what it feels like when it's clicking.
Right, and if you love the voice, you just think, oh, there is a voice that has found itself, and I'm going to take this in and have it be not exactly a tool in the toolbox, more like a kind of music that you play while you're thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
You know how certain music will help you elicit what needs to be elicited?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everyone has their superstitions and their rituals and their tools.
Yeah, sure.
I think in a way, the certain kinds of reading serve as fertility-making reading. They make you feel more alive to your own stuff. And without needing to mimic that voice at all, it goes in and it quickens the process inside.
That's because reading, and I understood this when I was working with my youngest son, who I've been doing a lot of homeschooling with, but I used to read with him when he was in regular school, and I mm-hmm understood, it hit me like a thunderbolt, really, that sometimes he was reading the words, he was speaking the words on the page, but he wasn't reading because he wasn't picturing it in his head. He wasn't
mm-hmm
taking it inside him. Reading, it hit me all at once, is a creative act. You must, the reader, it has to imagine what is happening.
Oh, absolutely.
Or else it,
absolutely.
He or she's not actually reading. You must imagine it. And so when you, as a writer, when you're reading, you've been brought into this imaginative place, which is not dissimilar to the writing experience, because you are finishing every scene that the writer begins. They can't
absolutely and completely. In fact, you know, Sven Burkert's describes the wonderful author and essayist Sven Burkert's describes that process terrifically well in one of his essays in his collection called the Gutenberg Elegies, I believe, in which he says that when any of us reads a marvelous work, the mind, our minds, bustle about constructing the set of the story and,
right.
and peopling it with rounded characters whom we imagine in detail. And
yeah.
I've always thought that was the most wonderful description, bustling about. I think it also explains how if we take a book to heart that we've read and for all our lives, it's very difficult to go and see someone's conception of that book in a film, for example.
Yes.
Because that's not at all how we conceived
yeah.
it. We thought, oh, no, they've got that wrong. It's this way. And
that's
and,
right. that's
and that's because we've imagined it so, so utterly specifically, so massively specifically. And that's a wonderful thing as well.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, this is why I think people are so this is why I used to get so irritated with books I didn't like before I understood what was happening, is because the writer was taking me somewhere. And I put myself there. I took myself imaginatively to that place, and I have this imagination that I've trained, and I'm feeling where they're taking me. And if I don't like it, it's really like being stuck in a room with the with you know, radio playing nothing but static. You know, it's such an unpleasant. but I'm guiding myself there. And I get so angry for this writer opening the door to this place that I don't want to be. But that's because I have to invest my own creative energy to go there. And so in a way,
it's
I'm summoning that place in myself.
It's true. But the privilege of being able to read, I know, would be any writer's first claim of one of the great joys of the life. William Maxwell said, and I use it as an epigraph for one of the essays in this book, quote, "All I ask of life is the privilege of being able to read,"
yeah.
unquote.
That's where it all began.
And I think it's the foundation. If you ask any writer, they will say, oh, well, I read this and that when I was little, and it changed everything forever.
Absolutely,
for me.
Absolutely. There's been only about two writers I've interviewed in the hundreds I've had a chance who it didn't start that way. Every once in a while, it's not the case, but it was for me, for sure, because that's where you get, and I think that if you really are a writer, if that's the means by which you want to communicate with the world, that you will absorb, even though MFA programs are nice and the classes, it's all fine, I think you will really learn, you will absorb in the reading how a story is told. You will just absorb
it,
and that will
be
probably your biggest, you know, for instance, I remember when I read T.S. Eliot when I was 17, it was, I can literally remember putting the thing down saying, oh, you can do that. I get it. You can be simple and poetic, conversational and poetic.
That is true. And that is how people react, writers react when they find something wonderful. Oh, you can do that, which is a lovely revelation.
Yeah.
A lovely revelation.
Yeah, and it really does begin, that really is, just, I think for almost every writer, that is your first and greatest teacher.
It is. I think both the writing and the reading in any writer's life are finally a way of being in the world. It's a way of marking an identity out, but also a way of relating to the world that makes the world more apprehendable to you and less overwhelming. If in fact you've marked your identity out in this way, if you are going to say, I will understand the world by these books that come to me and by the language that I make, then the world is more doable that way.
What a lovely note to end our show on. Joan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Bill. It was a joy. I hope we do it again.
Oh, indeed we will. Remember, everybody, that is Because You Have To, A Writing Life by Joan Frank. We've been chatting about The Writing Life today. We'll probably chat about it again next week when I have Jeffrey's Pretty on and Melissa Stutter, and we'll be talking about interviewing and writing and many more things. Until then, remember, it's worth it because you have to do what you love. And I'll tell you, you really can't go wrong. You'll be surrounded by that which you love. Till next time.